What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to the show. Today we have a Q&A episode. Thank you to everybody who asked a question. We got a lot of good feedback on the weighted vest video. So thank you to everybody who listened. That was a fun one to make. I actually was not aware of what a lot of the research said. I've seen a lot of people wearing weighted vests. I've heard a lot of interesting things said about wearing a weighted vest, but I was intrigued with what the research had to say, and I hope that that can be a good resource for people who are considering wearing a weighted vest or telling their clients to wear a weighted vest or just in general seeing people do that. So awesome. Without further ado, let's jump in. First question. P.S. I don't look at these questions beforehand, so sometimes there's a, you know, these anonymous ones, sometimes there's a weird question, we just skip it. So anyway, first question. Last week, I smashed my Monday upper session and PR'd in everything. It was bizarre. Usually, it's a bloody grind after years of lifting and sometimes have to lower weight and correct form. Yeah, that happens. This week, I sucked. I had to drop weight on one exercise and just felt like a serious struggle bus situation. Why? I will say immediately, if you're a female and you have a menstrual cycle, there can be some fluctuations in performance based on where you are in your menstrual cycle. Everybody's menstrual cycle will affect them. Every woman's menstrual cycle will affect them differently. There's no necessarily, I mean, there are some maybe commonalities on average, but you know, people aren't an average, they're an individual. So you might be experiencing something that's individual to you. You're a little bit weaker on 1 week, a little stronger on another week, etc. So it could be that. In general, though, there are so many things that can affect acute performance: how you slept, the weather, the humidity, hydration status, stress level, you know, acute nutrition, chronic nutrition, so many things, so sodium levels, you know, if you had missed your creatine after a couple of days, you know, well, that one's not so much. That one comes and goes a little bit over a little bit longer period. But if you have a week, it's kind of like, I think about it almost like kind of like your weigh-ins, where there's just a natural fluctuation to things in the short term. If you have a workout where you absolutely crush it, you probably overperformed your average, right? And so when you, even the following week where you're like, I should be stronger, there are so many acute variables. If you're coming off of an amazing workout where you PR'd on everything, the idea that you're going to be able to maintain that kind of top-end performance, yeah, probably not. If you have an amazing workout and you PR on everything, just like you have a big whoosh in your weight one morning, you probably are looking at things leveling off the next time you get into the gym. And this happens to me often, especially with the experiment I'm doing with my training where, you know, I'm only doing one working set and we don't need to go into that right now. I'm going to record a whole podcast kind of when I'm maybe halfway through. But yeah, dude, if you PR on something and you have a really great session and you finally put it together, you finally got that last rep, just know that maybe it was because the stars aligned on that day. And that doesn't mean that you're not making gains. I'm not saying the stars aligned and, you know, you just randomly were stronger that day. But the stars aligned insofar as acute factors manifested in such a way where you were able to perform that well on that day. And that might not always be the case. And so we're just looking for a long-term trend. I just think that this highlights a bit of an overemphasis on the short term, right? Like if I'm going to pull out my program. I just want to read something to you guys. I'm going to read you my progression for, I'll pick a random exercise. The first one that today I did flat dumbbell press. So flat dumbbell press, I did 90 for six. These are each week, 90 for six, 90 for seven, 90 for six. I lost a rep, 90 for seven, 95 for six, 95 for six, 95 for five. I lost a rep, 95 for six. This morning I did that 95 for six, and I know in my heart I'll be able to get 95 for seven in the next week or two. And so what you saw was there were some weeks where I lost a rep and many weeks where I repeated the same effort. But I guarantee you over the course of this, let's call it a 16-week experiment, every single thing I'm doing, I will be stronger at. And so your goal is not necessarily to progress and get stronger every week. That would be a miracle. When I say that would be a miracle, I mean, if you're brand new to lifting, that will happen to you. You will quite literally get stronger every week. But if you've been training for a while, you're not actually getting stronger every week. And so what you need to do is you need to try and do more each week, right? You're trying to push yourself harder each week. The reason you try to do that is that so when you zoom out every 4, 6, 10 weeks, you'll know that you're stronger, right? It is not the case that you're going to progress every week, but trying to progress every week is how you look back every 6-8 weeks and progress, right? So just, I'll say that one more time, we'll move on, which is that it's not that you have to progress every week, but you try to, and you try to do that because it is the pursuit of progression, the really hard training where you're trying to push yourself a little bit more that causes the adaptations that ultimately does make you grow muscle and get stronger. Next question is, right now I can usually work out 4 days and I do 3 times per week, full body plus 1 zone 2 or 3 cardio day. Gotcha. So you're working out 4 days a week. 3 of those are workouts or lifting sessions. 1 of them is a cardio day. At the end of lifting, I try to do some higher intensity cardio, like 10 to 15 minutes. 1 day it's the air bike intervals, 1 day a higher intensity circuit. Suggestions for a 3rd day, are these shorter bouts effective? I think they are effective. I don't think they are effective. They absolutely are effective. And if this is your way of kind of micro dosing some higher intensity cardio such that it nets out to being a productive amount at the end of the week, right? Like, would I like you to maybe instead of doing this every day, pick 2 days and get maybe a 30 to 40 minute session that has some higher intensity work in it? Probably. But if you're like, hey, I don't have more days per week, but I might have 10 or 15 more minutes per workout. Is this an effective strategy? I think it is. Exactly how you're structuring those sessions, I might be interested in. You know, if you're doing a 15 minute session, maybe you're doing 1 minute hard and 2 minutes easy, and you're doing 5 rounds of that. Or you're doing 30 seconds hard and 2 minutes easy, and you're doing 6 rounds of that or something, right? I think that can be effective. I'm trying to think if there are other sorts of like 10 to 15 minute style workouts. I mean, if you really are truly looking for higher intensity, it's got to be at least like a 1-to-2 ratio. So 1 minute, 1 unit of time working and for every 2 units of time spent recovery. I mean, if you're doing like 1 minute of hard work and then 1 minute of, I mean, that's possible if you're fit, right? 1 minute on, 1 minute off. And I think 1 minute on, 1 minute off is also an effective strategy. I wouldn't necessarily call it high intensity, but yeah, higher than zone 2, let's say. So suggestions for a 3rd day, you're at the end of the lifting, I try and do some cardio. So, okay. So you're doing air bike intervals. You're doing a higher intensity circuit. I might do something like, 1 day is 30-second intervals with 2 minutes or at least 90 seconds of rest. And then another day is maybe, you know, 2-minute intervals with 2 minutes of recovery. And then maybe another day is like, you know, two or three 4-minute intervals. I know that might exceed your 10 to 15 minute marker, but I still think we're talking about sub 20 minutes here. As far as the implement that you use, like the modality, bike, Stairmaster, elliptical, if you're just looking for general fitness, I don't think sticking to the same thing is all that important. I think you can do elliptical 1 day, stair 1 day, bike 1 day. I would say, I guess, because you're asking me here, I wouldn't sleep on the elliptical. I think if they weren't, you know, I'm sure you can find one that's not that expensive, but if I had the space and the money, I would own an elliptical. It's just a really good modality that translates well to running without, it doesn't translate perfectly, of course, translates pretty well though, and has basically no impact. And you can choose if you want to use the arms as well, which can be a feature. So I think elliptical would be really great. That would be my suggestion is, you know, split up the working interval time just a little bit, maybe something sub 1 minute, maybe something in the 1-to-3 minute range and something in the 4-to-6 minute range. And then I don't mind if you change up the modality and definitely don't sleep on the elliptical. Don't go to sleep while using the elliptical is what I mean, of course. All right, next question. Wondering food timing is problematic for gains. I wake up at 3 a.m. and have coffee and creatine, work out from 4 to 5 a.m. and don't eat until 11. If I eat earlier, I tend to want too many calories by the end of the day, plus I'm super busy till then. Female, 150 pounds, I'm cutting 130 or more grams of protein, 1650 calories. I do your program 3 to 4 days a week. So let's get to the nuts and bolts here. If you take a parallel universe, you take the exact same macros and you take your scenario where you're eating, let's say you're working out at 4 and you don't eat till 11. And then in another parallel universe, everything is exactly the same, except that person has a protein shake right afterwards. Maybe 100 calories, 25 grams of protein, a scoop of protein in water. That's it. Do I think those people look different over 10 years? Probably not, you know, again, because habitually we're talking about the same calories and protein. However, on a mechanistic level, by the way, we're never going to be able to do that study. So while I would suspect that this doesn't matter a whole lot, all else equal, I think if you do look at the mechanisms, while there isn't really an anabolic window, if you are eating regularly, you're not eating regularly, right? Like you're working out and you're not eating for another 6 hours. You're not eating for the first 8 hours of your day. And so that would represent to me a tangible downside, at least theoretically from a mechanism standpoint, that you'd be missing out on some muscle growth. So here's the deal. If you were my client, I would say, I don't care if you add 100 calories, it's worth it. So if you just added 100 calories to your day and had it, let's say right after your training, and now you're at 750 calories, to me, I think you will end up happier. Like it will end up in a more favorable place. Between the thermic effect of feeding, maybe that's like an extra net 60, 70 calories. Let's call it 70 calories. And I just think that it is a meaningful addition to your overall body composition journey, such that I would do it. You know, they also have these genius shots that came out, these like 23 grams of protein for 90 calories. I mean, that's the same as a protein shake. It's just in a smaller bottle. So I would suggest you have a protein shake, even if it increases your calories. And if you don't want to do, if you don't want to play that game where you're like, no, I'm going to stick to 1650, then I would still suggest you have 25 grams of protein after your workout at some point sooner than 11 o'clock. I would, even though I just said that the outcome of over 10 years, I don't think it matters much. I still think it's such, I still think there's a percentage chance that I'm wrong about that. And it's an easy enough thing to fix. It's not like it's like, hey, I want you to, you know, scale Everest while juggling, you know, Rubik's Cube while you figure it out. So it's like an easy, easy thing to rectify. Even if there's only a 1% chance I'm wrong, it's not a hard thing to fix. I would do it, even if it meant actually increasing your calories. Next question is, what to do when going through times of physique frustration? Been at this for 5 years now and probably don't look like it really. Probably need to shed a layer of fat. Don't want to. LOL advice. Yeah, I would go to therapy, and I don't mean that like, whenever someone is suggested to go to therapy, people, I think there's a, just from a therapy stigma, it's like I'm saying there's something wrong with you. What I'm saying is you should work through why looking a certain way is so important to you, such that it sounds like it's muddying the enjoyment of it all. And that introspection of why looking a certain way is so important is something that I think is really done well with a professional. I know nobody really wants to hear this from me, but that is something I worked with a professional on, frankly. I've been going to therapy for about 3 years now, and you know, I just feel like the outside world would be like, yeah, well, you still look great. It's like, I'm telling you right now, I have been much bigger and much leaner. I weigh 189 pounds right now. I've been like 217. I've been 210 lean. You know, I've squatted 500 pounds. I've benched 325 pounds. I can't do any of that right now. And it's because I've shifted my priorities to things outside of being as big and lean as I can possibly be. And I would not have been able to get to the place I am in terms of my relationship with my body and food and just mental health without talking about this in therapy. I would have never gained the tools to be as introspective and curious about that without having somebody alongside me. So, you know, my advice, I wish I had better advice than go seek help. You know, I don't want that to be taken as, you know, in the way that it might sound, but I think we could all do well to have a professional sounding board to work through why looking a certain way is so important to us. Next question. If I was a one-on-one client in fat loss, would you have me track vegetables as my, you know, part of my daily calorie intake? I would not tell you what to do. I'd start with that. There's no part of my coaching. Well, I try to do a bit more of what's called motivational interviewing, which is not making firm decisions for my clients, but rather walking them to making that decision for themselves. And I would explore with you how tracking, let's call it like green cruciferous vegetables. So, you know, and green is arbitrary, just low calorie cruciferous vegetables like peppers and onions and mushrooms and leaves and Brussels sprouts, broccoli. You can take this in three different ways. You can you can weigh and track those things meticulously, right? So you can weigh out your broccoli and weigh out your mushrooms and weigh out your spinach and weigh out your onions. That's option one. I will say between me and you that it's rare I would have somebody do that, except in the beginning. In the beginning, you weigh friggin' everything so you can learn, right? Right? Just like you, if you were trying to manage your finances, you would say, well, do I have to track that coffee? It's like, hey, for now, while we're building this habit and while the beginning stages of doing this is about bringing awareness to your spending, I think it's a good idea to track and measure everything. Is it likely that you'll get to a point where you might say, well, maybe I'll track this stuff, but I'll eyeball it? Because the difference, you know, most people can eyeball, in my opinion, vegetable within like, you know, 75% of the calories. So, or the weight, let's say. Like after you do it, let's say you weigh and measure for a month, I bet you you can eyeball the weight of a portion of vegetables in your own home that you eat often, you know, within a 75% margin. And so if you're off by 25% of like 60 calories of spinach, okay, so you're off by 15 calories. To me, the option two is track your vegetables, but don't weigh them, eyeball them, because you've done this long enough to get in the ballpark and, you know, the lack of putting it on the food scale might be a net increase in mental health, improvement in mental health. And then option three is not put them in your tracker at all. I personally don't put them in my tracker at all. And that is mostly because I'm okay with being less precise, right? I understand that the downside of not tracking, you know, when I make a salad, I've been posting my food a little bit more lately. I'm tracking for a bit again. You guys see there's like four things tracked, but like 50 things in there. Like maybe I'll have like onions and cherry tomatoes and the base, like a spring mix. Maybe there's like some baby carrots, maybe there's some mushrooms, and none of that is in my screenshot of how I tracked it. Now, I know those calories still exist, and I personally am okay not being as precise because I know if I'm gaining or losing weight, I can probably just increase or decrease my calories, keep my methods the same, and it's all going to work out. So to answer your question, I would not force you to do anything. I would suggest that you track and weigh everything in the beginning for a period of time. Could be a week, could be a month. After that, we would revisit your mental health around these habits. And if you're feeling like, well, it would be meaningful for me to just eyeball this stuff because it doesn't really make a huge difference calorically. And that would be something meaningful for me from a longevity, from like a habit longevity standpoint. I would nod along with you and we would move to that strategy. If you wanted to not track them at all, then I would say, great, let's try that. And let's see how we do in terms of improvements in mental health and how we do with being a little bit less precise. And in my estimation, you'd do just fine. Even if, like, as long as your methods are consistent and your numbers are reliable, that is something I've said for many years verbatim. And what that means is it's like tracking your food raw versus cooked. If you track it cooked, you are missing calories, right? Because if you track it as 8 ounces of salmon, but 8 ounces of cooked salmon is probably more like 10, 11 ounces of raw salmon. So if you're making that, if you're tracking it as a raw entry, but you weighed it cooked, you're probably missing calories. Now, that doesn't matter as long as you do it all the time. Because if your calories are always off on average by the same percentage in the same direction, and you're not losing weight, people will say, well, you're not losing weight because you're missing all those calories. No, you're not losing weight because you're not in a deficit and we could just lower your calories from here, right? Like even if you all of a sudden start tracking all that stuff and you find out, oh, I was eating 200 calories extra per day, the answer to what do I do now is lower your calories. So you could have lowered them before. Now you're lowering them after doing more work to track everything. So potentially a podcast for another day. Next question. Knowing that you have a genetic disposition for high cholesterol, I do. Are there any lifestyle or habit changes you've implemented that you didn't previously? As always, thanks for the content. So yeah, I talked about this in previous podcasts, so I won't over-egg it here. Not the question. I'll answer your question. But I have a genetic, I have two copies of what are called the APOE4 allele. Brief description of this. APOE is an apoprotein that we all inherit one copy from our mom and one copy from our dad. And you can either have an ApoE2 or 3 or 4. And you get one of each. So you can get an ApoE2 from mom and an ApoE2 from dad, or a 2 from mom and a 3 from dad, or a 4 from dad and a 4 from mom. You can have any combination. There's 6 combinations, right? 2-3, 2-4, 3-4, 2-4, whatever, 4-4, whatever. There's 6 combinations. 3-3, about 75% of the population is what we'd call homozygous ApoE3, meaning you have double copy of that one. So you have ApoE3 from mom, ApoE3 from dad. And that is our like baseline for risk of neurodegenerative disease, risk of cardiovascular disease, things like Alzheimer's, heart disease, et cetera. If you have a copy of ApoE2, you are at less risk. If you have a double copy of ApoE2, you're at even less risk. If you have a single copy of ApoE4, you are at more risk. If you have a double copy of ApoE4, you are at the most risk. You are roughly 12 times as likely to have Alzheimer's or contract Alzheimer's or develop Alzheimer's dementia. And it impacts, you know, less than 3% of the population. I am homozygous ApoE4. I have dual copy of this not so great gene. And you can do this. I don't have any affiliation with these companies, but you can get your genetic testing done at a myriad of different ways. In a myriad of different ways from different companies, et cetera. And they will all have this allele, this test. Here I am. I am, you know, and by the way, that tracks. There's Alzheimer's all over my family. Just like every family member that has, every grandparent I've had, like died of neurodegenerative disease or had neurodegenerative disease late in their life. So that tracks, by the way. So that ApoE4, my genetic disposition here, one of the things it does from a blood marker perspective is you have genetically higher cholesterol on average, LDL cholesterol. And that's funny because right around when I figured this out, my dad and I were working on his cholesterol, and he is a relatively fit guy, like lean, like goes for a lot of walks. He should lift more weights, whatever. Eats a lot of fiber, eats a good diet. And his LDL was still high. And I was like, hey dad, like this is one of those things where we genetically are predisposed for higher cholesterol. And so this might be a time where medication is prudent, whatever. The question that you have asked is, since finding that out, are there lifestyle changes I've implemented that you didn't previously? I will list the ones that you should do, and then I'll list the ones that maybe changed for me. Most of them are the things you already know to be healthy, right? It's like, don't have too much body fat, eat a nutritious diet, get your sleep, manage stress, don't drink a lot of alcohol, don't smoke, lift weights, do cardio, don't eat too much saturated fat. Make sure you eat a high fat diet. A high fiber diet. Eat more plant protein. Any other ones on that list? I've mentioned before making sure your coffee is filtered. Most coffees that you're going to get are filtered, but if you're making coffee at home through like a French press and you don't use a paper filter, for some people that can raise cholesterol notably by like 4 to 8%. And so that's a pretty easy thing to fix. Just make sure your coffee is being filtered through some sort of paper filter. It traps, I think they're called diptyramines or something. Get your coffee filtered. So what are the things that I have implemented since finding this out? I will say I was doing most of those things, right? Healthy lifestyle, TM, right? The things I've changed are I've decreased my red meat intake. Listen, not all saturated fat affects the body the same way. The saturated fat from animal proteins and butter raise your LDL cholesterol and are worse for you than, let's say, saturated fat from things like dark chocolate. And so I love dark chocolate. That's great. I can keep eating that. But I've decreased my red meat intake notably. I've increased my intake of plant protein. And I will make a post somewhere about this, but I am 34 years old. I've been a nutrition professional maybe for the last 10. I think around 25, I became a real adult and started doing a good job with my business. I've been sleeping on beans and I've been sleeping on, I'm going to confess to that on social media. I've been sleeping on beans, man. I know they're not as high in protein as animal sources, chicken breast, Greek yogurt, but they have, let's take black beans for a sec, because those are the macros on top of my mind. There's 8 grams of protein and 8 grams of fiber I think it's 120 calories, black bean macros. Yeah, 114 calories, let's say 120, 8 grams of protein, 8 grams of fiber. So yeah, if you want to know that a food is high in protein, a very simple back of the envelope math that you can do is you can take the protein per serving, multiply it by 10, and if the food has that many calories or less, it's high in protein. If it has more than those calories, then, you know, it's not super high in protein. So if you take a food that has, you know, 8 grams of protein per serving for 80 calories, so times 10, then that's, you can consider that high in protein. But if it has 8 grams of fiber, in this case, there's 114 calories, most people would say black beans are not high in fiber. High in protein. However, it's like this, it might not be the highest protein food in the world, right? But it has, it's like a one-to-one protein to fiber. So there's 8 grams of protein and 8 grams of fiber. So in your pursuit of increasing protein and fiber, yeah, beans aren't elite at protein, but they are pretty good in two very important categories, protein and fiber. And so in your pursuit of increasing both protein and fiber, beans are just like unbelievable for hacking that. Plus, volume-wise, you actually get quite a bit of beans. I added like one serving of beans to a salad the other day, and I was like, dude, there's so many beans in the salad. So don't sleep on beans. And we have studies basically where people do exactly what I'm saying, is they swap out animal fat and animal protein for plant protein, beans, legumes, you know, soy, et cetera. And we see a notable reduction in LDL. So for me, it's an increase in plant protein. Also, while we're on this whole beans thing, the second thing that made me sleep on beans and why I'm not sleeping on beans is because I used to be so obsessed with getting a mega, mega, mega high amount of protein in, you know, like over a gram per pound. And so the more protein you're trying to eat, the less you can spend any of your calories on anything that's not mega high in protein. But I've just changed a little bit of my take on protein in the context of, well, most people outside of a lean person trying to get even leaner, that person I think still needs a pretty darn high amount of protein. But you just probably don't need as much protein as I would have said 5-10 years ago. I don't tell anybody really that they need a gram per pound unless they're a lean person trying to get leaner, really worried about muscle loss. You know, to get like 0.7 grams per pound of protein in just means I don't need to eat like 55 grams of protein per meal. I can get by, me personally, with like 40, which means I can afford to spend some calories on a food that's slightly less high in protein, like black beans. I just think that this general, just a slight decrease in the obsession with mega high, I think protein's mega important, but mega high levels of protein has opened the door for spending some more calories on things like beans. So things that I've changed, the big one is less red meat, more plant protein. I never cooked with butter really. The other thing is checking my ApoB levels every couple of years, or, you know, my lifestyle is pretty consistent, so every couple of years will do. It's not like I'm going through big swings, but get your ApoB checked. It's an unbelievably good marker for cardiovascular disease. And there's just a lot of overlap between risk factors for cardiovascular disease and neurodegenerative disease, at least on the vascular side of things. So just, again, overall being healthy, really, really, really important. But for me, the big one has been more plant protein in place of animal protein, namely from red meat. Sweet. Next question. What are we at, 30 minutes? This isn't a good start to the question. Not necessarily a good podcast question, but I have a friend who needs to start reading the kind of content that you put out, but isn't on social media. Got you. Peeked at your website and there isn't that sort of content on your website. Yeah. You said, what about a list of podcasts or workout and nutrition related content? I think the podcast is a good place to go. My website, there's no like blog really. I don't do any like long form content on there. So not really a good place to find me. You could always send her some posts. And so him or her, did you say him or her? Him or her. You could always send him or her a post that you find helpful. I think I would need a more specific thing. I mean, you can always search my podcast for keywords, but you said, hey, workout and nutrition related. I mean, every single thing I put out on social media and my podcast is workout and nutrition related. So if you have a specific piece of content, somewhere where you think hey, I'd love something on protein, or hey, I'd love something on fiber. You can always message me on social media, or you can message me. This person can email me, right? You can email me on my website. And I'm happy to see if I can find a good piece of content for you. So if they want to reach out, if you want to reach out, you can email me, you can contact me on social media, and I will try and find a piece of content for that specific topic. Also, at the moment, my primary source of income is a combination of one-on-one coaching for nutrition and my group training program. And since I'm not currently taking one-on-one clients as per this recording, I don't have a lot of that rhetoric on my site. And so you'll probably see a lot of workout-related content on my website, or at least workout-related marketing, because, you know, that's where I'm trying to drive people to at the moment. All right, next question. If you're eating in a slight deficit, but still pushing to add reps or weight each week, will you gain muscle, albeit slow? Yeah, probably is the answer. Probably. Listen, the more trained you are, the less likely you can build muscle in a deficit. But technically, even really trained people can build muscle in a deficit if they have all their ducks in a row. If they're sleeping enough, eating enough protein, eating enough consistently, training hard, managing stress, they have good nutrition quality, they can still build muscle. There's a paper by Chris Barakat et al. That looked at this question of can trained individuals build muscle in a deficit? And the answer is they can. Will everybody? I don't know. I don't think every single participant in every single one of those studies built muscle, but it showed that it is not just an outlier, that it is absolutely within the realm of possibility that you build muscle, but you need all your ducks in a row, because what you don't have is a surplus of building materials, right? So if your question is, if there's a secondary question built in here, which says, if I'm adding weight and reps, am I building muscle? That's a really good sign. I think it's tough to say absolutely that is the case, but shit, that's a really, really, really good sign. You know, if you were like, hey, am I building muscle while I'm in my cut? My first question to you would be, are you getting stronger? That isn't sufficient, but it is necessary, right? You'd have to at least be maintaining to make a really good case that you're building muscle. Here's what I would say though. Your cut should be a very small percentage of your life, right? You might cut. Listen, if you're a person in a larger body and you're cutting from a heavier weight, let's say you're, I don't like using BMI categorizations, but it just puts things in perspective a little bit. If you have obesity and you're doing this, you are more likely able to build muscle during this period. If you're leaner, it's a little bit harder. If you're very lean, it's near impossible / very hard. So yeah, adding weight and reps or gaining strength is at the very least maintaining your strength is probably necessary to say that you're building muscle, but it might not be sufficient. There's probably some other things going on here, but your cut should be such a small percentage of your life that this doesn't matter. I don't care if you build muscle in your cut, because it should be a fraction of your life, and the amount of muscle that you'll build outside of that cut is like 99%, 99.9%. So I know that I'm not coming at you, question asker. All I'm saying is don't worry so much about, like, it's like you're trying to run from New York to, you're trying to get from New York to LA. And someone's like, does it matter if I walk or run? And the answer is like, well, what matters is the sooner you get back into a car or a plane, and you'll go much faster. Like, the difference between you spending a short period of time walking on your travels across the country, or you spend that time running, doesn't really matter. What matters is you find a car as soon as possible and you get in it so you can go much faster. It's like the amount of muscle you build in a cut in optimal circumstances versus maybe you lost a tiny bit of muscle just means nothing, because it is such a small fraction of time. And let's say you lost a tiny bit of muscle or you gained a tiny bit of muscle. It doesn't really matter, because it's such a small magnitude of effect compared to what's going to happen when you go back to eating more food. So, you know, I don't really care if people gain muscle in a cut. Just train hard enough to not lose muscle or to minimize muscle loss, and then get back to training in a more anabolic environment with more food. All right, next question. We'll do one or two more, see what I got time for. How would you best balance 4 days of running and 3 days of lifting? Do you need a rest day? No, you do not need a rest day. And I say need, meaning like you don't, by definition, by some sort of definition, need a rest day. You might find that your schedule and your preference is to train every day so that you never need a two-a-day, right? If you're trying to do 7 workouts in a week, you have a couple of options that I think are practical. You could do 5 days of training with 2 two-a-days. You could do 6 days of training with 1 two-a-day or 7 days of training with no two-a-days. I personally like having a rest day. I experience a net decrease in stress when I have a rest day. So if I were doing this, right now I'm lifting 3 days and running 4 days. Sorry, I'm lifting 3 days and running 3 days. So I train every day and I have a rest day. If I was going to run more, which I might, I'm going to do a two-a-day. I'm going to run on another day where I lift, and I'm going to keep my rest day. Now, that's not because of some universal must-do rule where you must have a rest day. It is my perception of the net stress. And so you might say, and it's your schedule too. You might say, hey, I don't have time in my day for a two-a-day. And frankly, that's kind of why I've been avoiding doing two-a-days. I know that running, doing one more easy run per week would help, but I just don't really have a great time that I want to allot to doing it. So the answer is you don't need a rest day. I personally, for myself, and I think on average for most people, having a rest day and having a two-a-day, I would rephrase that. Having a two-a-day so that you can have a rest day is probably going to be a more favorable way to go about it. But there is nothing to say that you can't train every day, and that is definitively worse in some way. It's not. We just don't know that to be true. And depending on your schedule and preferences, it might work out really, really well. Next questions. How to deal with friends / family / partner who want to eat out a lot when you don't? It feels like food is so ingrained in social lives. I will start by saying that, and I don't think you would disagree, that like there's nothing wrong or weird about food being a tool we use to A, express ourselves, B, enjoy, C, a tool that we use to get together, right? I do hear you though, as much as I'm going to pose that alternative perspective at the jump here, I do hear you where it's like, hey, can we do something together that isn't eating? You know, by the way, I love eating out. I don't do it that much right now, which is my wife and our baby. I like eating out. I like trying new restaurants. It was a part of my life earlier in my life. And so I'm at a point now where if we were like in a social group that like that was all they would want to do, I would yearn for another activity. My advice to you is to try and every time there's a question about how to deal with family / partners / friends about XYZ thing, I'm going to say what I'm going to say, but before I say it, I'm going to tell you, I know this is hard. I know this is hard, but I can't get away from the answer that you should just have open and honest discussion with these people because life is too freaking short. You should have an open, honest discussion about your feelings. And you should hope that if these are people worth having in your life, that they are the kinds of people you can have open, honest discussions with. Now, open, honest discussions usually imply, you know, you are having some sort of discussion around something, a disagreement, let's say. So I know that open, honest discussions about a disagreement or about a difference in perspective or opinion can be challenging, even with loved ones. But if they are really loved ones and really people that care about you, really people that you want in your life, you should be able to have open, honest discussions. And I'll just vent a little bit because you've lent me the opportunity to do so. You know, since having a baby, it's changed our family dynamics. So like my relationship with my mom, my dad, my brother, like my family, Jenna with her family, you know, our family together as a whole. And we've had to have some challenging conversations about boundaries, about how we are feeling, about exploring how my family is feeling, right? About seeing the baby, about what our boundaries are like. And it's been challenging, but they are loved ones and they are either the kinds of people who are going to be open to having a discussion, provided you're coming at it with compassion and curiosity and kindness, or they're not worth having in your life. And I know that sounds a little cutthroat, but when I say not having in your life, I mean a person whom I can't have that open, honest, compassionate, transparent discussion with is a person, you know, who I'm going to modify my relationship with them, right? I'm going to modify their place in my life, in my heart. Everything from, you know, a very cutthroat answer of like, I'm going to cut those people out to like, I'm going to modify how I think of them and how I interact with them and how frequently I interact with them and in what context, et cetera. So I hope that was helpful. I know that I wish there was an easier way, but talking to them and being open and honest is probably the best way. All right, we're going to cap it there. Fantastic question, guys. What a wonderful Q&A. Thank you for asking a question. I'll see you guys in the next episode. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.